couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's new movies include Captain Marvel, the documentary Apollo 11, another documentary Behind the Curve, and retro reviews of Nighthawks and 8mm. Plus, I'll be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring California, new from Shout Factory on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before I hit the news, I want to give a little bit of shout out to Glenda R. She sent me an email last week and boosted my opinion on Green Book, talking about the fact that she felt that it was the same. Here's a little excerpt. She said, "You hit the nail right on the head with your comments of the Best Picture winner Green Book. So much, quote, controversy around the Oscars is so tiring that it takes the fun out of the awards." And, you know, she's absolutely right. Sometimes people are so waiting for controversy and they want something negative. Can't we just enjoy a movie that has a positive message and enjoy it for its win? Why does that? And this is why I don't like to talk too much about snubs, because I feel that when you say something's been snubbed, it's been taken away from somebody else. And, you know, it's an award show. You got, well, at this point, 8 pictures nominated in the acting awards. You got 5 nominees. 4 of them are going to lose, or 7 pictures are going to lose. And that's just the way competition works. But let's be happy for the movies that win. So yes, Glenda, thank you very much for the email. Speaking of the Oscars, a little piece of news that is floating around the internet this week is that Steven Spielberg is going to be proposing rule changes for the Oscars at the annual board meeting in April. And it's caused a bit of a hubbub, because it's pretty clear he's targeting Netflix with this, and he's targeting streaming services. Now, I also find it kind of interesting that he wasn't a producer, but his company, Amblin Entertainment, did help produce Green Book, which, one, some people would say, well, nobody knows the inside of this, but probably very narrowly won over Roma. And Roma, that was pegged as going to be the winner. It's historic that it got so many nominations and so many awards. I mean, Alfonso Cuarón won Best Director for it, won Best Foreign Film, and there's a lot of let's just say angst in the film industry right now for people who say the streaming giant of Netflix isn't being fair. And if you look at like some of the things that Spielberg's going to be proposing, like a longer window of theatrical exclusivity, and that it can't be streamed, because he's basically saying, look, if it plays on a television, it's a TV movie and should be considered for the Emmys. Now, there is a certain logic to that a movie's going to be either a TV movie for the Emmys or the Oscars. There needs to be lines delineated, and you need to have rules. The reason I have an issue with Spielberg is this is in direct response, it seems, to Roma doing so well. Where was he last year when Mudbound was just sort of percolating in the awards? Where was he a couple years ago when Beasts of No Nation was percolating in the awards? I think that the Roma juggernaut scared the crap out of some people, and they're worried that distribution model is going to take over. But here's the reality. Spoiler alert. This distribution model is taking over. I think Spielberg's suggesting a way to wedge around Netflix, but there's no way to stop this. This is innovation. There already are release windows that a film has to follow in order to be eligible for Academy Award consideration. And Netflix did that. It's like you have to have an exclusive run, and so many theaters are legitimate theaters, and they did that. They had a release window. That's important, and that's fine. Make whatever rules you want, but it seems like he's trying to carve out Netflix in specific. And the reason he's going after Netflix and not stuff like Amazon, because Amazon Studios has been cranking out movies that have been going on regular release schedule, like Manchester by the Sea. Manchester by the Sea went through a regular release schedule, won an Academy Award for a couple people, and it ended up going out of the theaters and then onto Amazon Prime, but it was not done in a way that it was launched like 2 weeks later on Amazon Prime. I think that's what's cheesing people off. Plus the worldwide distribution of Netflix bothers people, but this is how people do indeed watch movies. And it goes to a greater debate about what is the cinema experience? What's the theatrical experience? And the reality is more and more people are watching stuff at home. You don't have to see something in the theaters for it to be a movie. Now, what's interesting is Netflix went and bent over backwards to show this to critics on screens. They had so many screenings. They made a point to show it to me on the big screen. So when I could vote on it, I could see it on the big screen. But then they also sent me a bunch of discs so I could watch it at home if I needed to. And let's face it, a lot of the movies that are up for award consideration, critics see on disc. I watched Vice on disc because I just didn't have time to go to the screening. I watched Destroyer on disc. There's a lot of them that I do. I watched Mary Poppins on disc just because it was right at Christmas and things were crazy. And there were conflicting screenings. And so half the movies you see for award consideration, you see on disc anyways, because that's what the studios are doing. Now they're picking and choosing and they're just scared that Netflix is getting in their way. And that's where it's disingenuous. And it's actually Paul Schrader, who directed First Reform, who made the point that he doesn't hate Netflix for its model, but he said he went with A24 because A24 gave him a prestige release for First Reformed and got him some nominations and awards. And he thought he would have gotten buried if he took the Netflix deal. And that's true. You just have to have the right film for the right model. So I gotta say, you know, Spielberg seems to be gunning for somebody he really shouldn't. And then what the heck does he have to worry about? For crying out loud, the guy's won how many Oscars and he's always gotten movies into the theaters. Look, when he did The Post last year, he squeezed that in at the end of the year just because he thought it was politically important to do it. And he had no problem with that. What is he worried about, for crying out loud? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. First one I want to talk about is Dragged Across Concrete. Opens on March 22nd.
There's a reason I'm sitting behind this desk running things. And you're out there with a partner that's 20 years younger than you.
Hey, Anthony's got a mouth with his own engine, but he's solid.
I'm thinking about the kind of future I can offer my girlfriend.
Pops is a yesterday who ain't worth words.
Good heavens and praise be to him.
Your absence was a weight upon us.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonton.
I don't like doing things with so many question marks everywhere.
There's a lot of imbeciles out there.
This one stars Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson. It's a violent thriller about cops who get in trouble for beating on a suspect. It's by the same guy who directed and wrote Bone Tomahawk, but also Brawl and Cell Block, 99 or whatever it was. The one with Vince Vaughn that was a direct-to-video or smaller release. I don't know. This one, I've always liked Mel Gibson, even though he's had some checkered problems in his past. This one might look good, but I'm not a big fan of the just overly violent and grim movies that are just there to punish people. And that one, this kind of looks like it could be that. The next one I want to hit is Long Shot, which opens on May 3rd.
Secretary of State looking at us?
I kind of know her.
It's like kind of knowing a mermaid.
Do you tell people that?
She probably doesn't remember who I am.
Secretary Field would like to speak with you.
With me?
I can't shake this feeling that we know each other.
We do.
We do?
Picture me, I guess, maybe like 20 years younger, but like this.
Flarsky?
Yeah!
What are you doing these days?
I'm a journalist.
What is the relationship exactly?
I used to babysit for him.
You babysat for him?
Wow, time has not been kind.
I actually saw this trailer in the theaters last week when I went to go see one of my movies. And I gotta say, this one looks like it might be kind of funny. I mean, it seems that Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen have a certain degree of chemistry. They're both age appropriate for the roles that they're playing. And it looks like it might be a fun little movie. And I think it's kind of neat to have a romance with an older woman and a younger man. I mean, they're like 6 or 7 years apart, but not make it an older woman and a younger man. It's not like she's like 50. She's in her 40s. And let me tell you, Charlize Theron, she still looks great. So I think this looks like it might be a cute little film. It's going to be counter-programming to the Avengers, which might serve well for it. Who knows? Anyways, that's it. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Apollo 11 and Behind the Curve.
This is
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with one that's it's not exactly new this week. It came out last week, but they didn't have pre-release screenings of this. I went ahead to go see this anyways, partly because I was kind of interested in it. And that is Apollo 11. This documentary of the moon landing celebrates the historic events for its 50th anniversary in IMAX.
The whole Apollo program was designed to get two Americans to the lunar surface and back again to Earth safely. The enormity of this event is something that only history will be able to judge.
Apollo 11 has very simply been given the mission of carrying men to the moon, landing them there, and bringing them safely back.
I remember 20-some years ago, maybe close to 30 years ago, when the movie For All Mankind came out. I was really excited to see that. I never got a chance to see it in the theater because it only played in one screen in Columbus, and I wasn't able to get over there. And it was a documentary, a big-screen documentary, about the space race and about NASA's involvement, and it used all this footage, some of the stuff we've never seen before. Of course, that was 30 years ago. I always regretted never seeing it on the big screen because kind of part of the push of this was these aren't special effects. These are real things that are going on. This is what space looks like. And you get that a little bit with Apollo 11. Now, Apollo 11 is less about the space travel and more about the people behind it. And it's not a traditional documentary in the sense where you got a narrator and you got characters and through lines. It's really just an assemblance of footage. And you have a couple chyrons at the bottom or headers that tell who's who and what they're doing. But in general, you're just sort of dropped into mission control watching this stuff unfold around you. You know, some of it's very familiar. You know, you've seen Neil Armstrong stepping off of the ladder and saying one small step for man, all that kind of fun stuff that everybody remembers from the space race. But the most interesting stuff is the behind the scenes stuff with mission control and watching who's involved and how many people, just the sheer number of people it involves, but also putting you in there and seeing the size of the rocket on the IMAX screen. That's incredibly impressive. Just the sheer size of the rocket. It serves as such a stark reminder of what was accomplished. I mean, really, just putting three guys in a tin can and shooting them across imaginable void. It's sort of like trying to take a pea shooter and shooting it across the Gobi Desert and hitting a target the size of a quarter. The look at Apollo 11 is something we've seen a lot of for the last 50 years, but you've never seen it like this. And this is certainly going to appeal most to people who lived through it, people who watched it back on TV in 1969. I was born in 1971, so I wasn't even there for when it happened, but I grew up in that space age, and these images are indelible in my mind, and it's fascinating to see the new footage and the high-def footage. You know, it's the greatest movie that Stanley Kubrick has ever made. Just kidding. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next movie. But ultimately, Apollo 11 is, I wouldn't say it's nothing new because there are some new things you'll see in it, but it's what you'd expect. And for those of you out there who are all upset because they didn't have the planting of the American flag in First Man, it's there in this movie and it's there in spades. They spend a lot of time on that scene. So if you want to see the American flag and you want to see it planted on the moon, this movie shows it because First Man was a character study. This was about the mission, and that's critical to the mission. So Apollo 11 is a fantastic movie. Go see it in IMAX if you can. It is definitely one that should be seen on the big screen. And I'm going to have to say that it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Behind the Curve. The Flat Earth movement is examined by interviewing some of the most influential voices in its discipline.
It was well-versed in just about every conspiracy you can think of.
Chemtrails, 9/11.
Did you know they made up dinosaurs?
Nobody wants to admit that they've been fooled, but it's happened to every one of us.
If you look on Google Trends, it's like spike.
Why is it expanding the way it is? Right.
You'll see so-called evidence that seems scientific, and you go, huh, maybe they're onto something there.
Science is having a problem combating what we're doing because they don't know how to address it.
I want to believe this. This doesn't mesh with reality, so don't change my view. Change reality.
This kind of came under my radar last week, and this movie's been out for a while. It's been out since 2018, and it had a festival run, and then it had a release online. But it recently got released on Netflix, and so a lot of people have been talking about this, and I thought it was an interesting thing to talk about. And I thought it would make an interesting pairing with Apollo 11, because Apollo 11, there's no question, the Earth is round, the moon is round, we're orbiting things, and we're going up there. This movie, Behind the Curve, looks at the whole flat Earth movement. Now, there's a lot of people who aren't even aware that this movement has gained traction. Again, I wasn't even aware of it until about a year or so ago. I stumbled into the rabbit hole on YouTube. And there are people with the pictures of pouring water on a plate and saying, well, it rolls off, ergo, where would the oceans go, blah, blah, blah. And then you start going down and watching video after video of flat earthers. And it is insane how deluded these people are. And I know I'm sounding somewhat critical of them. And look, I'm all for skepticism. I am all for skepticism and questioning authority. And even in science, you got to question things that, you know, could be a theory or could be a proposal. But science, you need people to question it. But you may not need them to question it this way. And one of the things this movie does is it examines the flat Earth movement not in a degrading way. It shows how people get sucked into it and how they start to believe it. And granted, a lot of the empirical evidence you have just on your own, you can just look around and say, well, the Earth looks flat. I mean, that's a terrible way to do science. But then again, I've also been on cruise ships. I take cruises all the time. Most people don't have a chance to just stand out in the middle of the ocean. Most people, you're surrounded by land somehow. But you can go out on the bow or side of a cruise ship, and you can get a panoramic view of the ocean. So it's flat water. I mean, there's waves and all, but ultimately it's flat. But even if you just take anything that's straight, like even just look at the edge of the railing of the ship, you can see the slight curvature of the Earth as you look across the horizon, that it diverges from the flat end of the railing. And it's not a warp in the railing, because no matter where you look at it on the railing, no matter what straight edge you use, you will see that curve. So I've seen empirical evidence of just everyday stuff that the Earth is round. But the fact that these people who believe this don't accept that. And the way they do this is they show it's not just goofy, wacky people sitting on the front porch waiting for the black helicopters to come after them, and not just people who are deep diving into conspiracy theory. There's critical people who are involved in this movement. And it's a fascinating look, and they try to explain what would make people believe something like this. The other thing that's fascinating about it is the experiments that some of the flat earthers are doing that are essentially showing that the Earth is round, and it's confounding them. It's an interesting look at the anti-science that does go on and that can be supported by goofy wackadoodle sites on YouTube, on Twitter, and you can put anything up there and there's no real accountability. And I think that that's one of the reasons why Behind the Curve is interesting, is because it shows how you can get sucked into that and how you can kind of build this echo chamber and circle the wagons and not let any sort of actual real critical thought come in. So if you haven't seen Behind the Curve and you got Netflix, check it out, because it doesn't dismiss those people, but it does make a point that they are incorrect. I'm going to say that Behind the Curve kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Captain Marvel and the retro movie Nighthawks. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Captain Marvel. Brie Larson stars as this cosmic superhero stranded on Earth in the mid-90s trying to stop an invasion by shape-shifting aliens.
Your life began the day it nearly ended. We found you. With no memory, we made you one of us. So you could live longer, stronger, superior.
Something in my past is the key to all of this.
Would you like to know what you really are?
That was out there. I have to admit, that blurb of this was out there. And what's interesting with the superhero movies is I remember, what was it, 10 years ago when they were starting, most people weren't acclimated to the really deep diving into the superhero characters. Everyone understands who Superman is. He's an alien with superpowers. Boom, that's pretty easy to understand. Batman, that's easy to understand. It's a billionaire who dresses up and he's really good at fighting and he beats up bad guys. You know, Iron Man is basically Batman. And, you know, Spider-Man is a guy who's bitten by a spider, gets radioactive powers. The Hulk, he gets mad, he turns into this big green rage monster. These are things that are easy to digest for the average audience. And I remember when Thor came out, it came out the same year, around the same time as the Green Lantern movie, which I know the Green Lantern movies is often maligned. But Green Lantern and Thor were both these cosmic characters. And even though people knew Thor and Thor's hammer and maybe some peripheral knowledge of Norse mythology, it's an out there story, this rainbow bridge that takes them to the stars with these Viking superheroes that are really gods and they're fighting this. And you got Loki, who's this trickster. There was a lot of stuff that they had to digest for the average viewer for Thor. And they took their time doing it. And Thor was a struggle to get through in some ways because it was out there. It's an out there story. Same thing with Green Lantern, these guardians of the universe who hand out these rings that allow people to create things with their will. It was really kind of just getting past the premise is tough for some people. Well, now we've had 10 years of superhero movies, and we've had the Guardians of the Galaxy, and we've had Doctor Strange, who's a sorcerer who can do some pretty crazy stuff. So now when you introduce a character like Captain Marvel, which is not the original Captain Marvel from Fawcett Comics. Shazam will have his day in about a month. But right now with Captain Marvel, there have been multiple Captain Marvels in the comics, and they have to get people acclimated to who this is. But because we're so used to the Kree and these aliens, and it doesn't cause the average person distress trying to figure out what's actually going on. Even though when you watch this movie, I was about 15 minutes into this movie, and I go, I have no idea what's happening, but it looks cool as heck. And that's kind of what this movie is, and that's what the Marvel movies have become, a way to ease people into these more cosmic, out there, bizarre, out-of-the-box superheroes. And that's why you could not have done a Captain Marvel movie like this 10 years ago. People just would have rejected it. They would have been like, it makes no sense. What is this, Kree alien? She's got blue blood, and she has these things blowing out of her fist. What's going on? And so Captain Marvel works now, and it's the perfect time to release something like this. Brie Larson is great in the role, and for all the people belly aching about feminism and what, you know, she shouldn't be a super, just shut up. This is just, it's a superhero movie. Let people have their superhero movies. This is a perfectly acceptable superhero movie. It's neat to have it go back in the 90s, so you get all that 90s nostalgia with Blockbuster Video and Radio Shack and fax machines and all that good stuff. You see a young Nick Fury, played, of course, by Samuel L. Jackson. And you get to see a little bit of Easter eggs in his development, stuff that answers questions that we've seen and enriches his character a little bit more. You see other little Easter eggs from the Marvel Universe. There's some parts in here where the story doesn't quite work, and some of the writing, like one of the bits that they have in there, one of the elements is she has a friend from her past that she goes to, and that friend's not very well written. It's just sort of, it seems like a stock character thrown in there. And there's occasional lines of dialogue that I remember thinking in the theater going, ooh, that one didn't land right. But that's what you get with all these superhero movies. And I compare this a lot to the original Thor because it's out there, it's bizarre, it's cosmic, it's different, and it's not perfect, but it certainly is an enjoyable movie, and it's a fun ride. It runs about 2 hours, and it's a great lead-in to Avengers Endgame, which we get to see in, what, like just under 2 months. So, yeah, Captain Marvel works as a film. I say huge kudos to Marvel for making a bizarre out there character like this work on the big screen and be accessible to the mainstream. This is your modern hero movie, and it works perfectly for that. So I'm going to have to say Captain Marvel rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. This next film I want to talk about is a recommendation, a listener recommendation. I haven't done one of those in a long time. But this comes from Jason from Facebook, who's also in charge of the Sample Chapter podcast. I was on that podcast 6 months ago or something like that. Search that on iTunes. Give a subscribe. Give a like. Give some love to Jason. Jason wanted me to check out Nighthawks, which was made in 1981. And it's a gritty action film from the 80s. Sylvester Stallone and Billy Dee Williams star as New York City street crime cops who are brought in for a plan to capture an international terrorist.
You are to be indoctrinated in counter-terrorist techniques.
Deke De Silva, age 35. Born and raised New York City. Honorable discharge, U.S. Army, 1972. 52 registered kills. Occupation, cop.
I love sort of those 80s gritty action movies, and I remember a couple weeks ago I talked about Cobra and how fantastic Cobra is, because Cobra is so over the top. And Jason had suggested Nighthawks, and I'm like, I can't remember whether I've seen this before. And in watching it again, I was like, yeah, I think I have, because there's elements to this. Let's just put it this way. Like, the movie opens up with these street punks going to attack this woman walking home, and it turns out that it's Sylvester Stallone in a dress pretending to be a potential victim, and he goes and he beats up the bad guys. There's a lot of Sylvester Stallone in women's clothes in this movie, an alarming amount, I would say, especially for 1981. But they were working with that as the juxtaposition to his tough guy image, but he was using that as bait. You know, he's the wolf in sheep's clothing, so to speak. And it's not like Cobra in the sense that Cobra, I think everybody knew that Cobra was cheesy from the beginning. This one, they really take it seriously. What's fascinating about this is Rutger Hauer plays the bad guy in it. He is this international terrorist who's blowing up boutiques in London, and his plan is to go to America and do some big terrorist attack. They don't know what it is. Somebody sneaks guns in everywhere. I know it was New York in the 80s, but come on. Or he's going to blow up the UN or something like that. And they bring in the street crime guys to help out, because they have this history and this experience with terrorism, because they were in Vietnam, and which is a huge trope that was used a lot in the 1980s. The beginning of the movie seems like just a gritty, relatively low budget street cop movie. But about halfway through, it turns into this blockbuster film where there's a big action, not an action scene, but a big confrontation scene on the cable car that goes to Roosevelt Island. That wasn't cheap to shoot. They had helicopters coming by and cables coming down from the cable car. They have a scene in there where a bus leaps across a divide and crashes into the East River. They have explosions. They have bombings. It becomes a pretty big deal of a movie. It becomes actually kind of impressive from a budgetary standpoint at the end. I mean, it's still corny and cheesy, and I have seen it before. I remember bits and pieces of it. It never really stuck in my head. I have to say, it's not my favorite cheesy 80s movie, and it does lean too much on being too serious, but it is a little absurd for as serious as it gets. So if you really want to re-experience the gritty underbelly New York seedy cop movie that turns into an international terrorism movie, Nighthawks can work, but I look back on it and I have to say it kind of sucks.
Okay,
and that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be doing a vintage review of 8mm, talk about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring California. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish off the film reviews with a retro review. I got to admit, this is another one, kind of like what I talked about, I think it was last week, and I talked about Single White Female that kind of disappeared under a stack of Blu-rays I was reviewing. And so it's a little bit late to talk about this simply because the new Blu-ray from Shout Factory came out, I believe, for 8mm. It came out this year in 2019, so it was sometime in January. A little late on covering it, but I wanted to cover it, and this was an interesting retro look. You know, it's a 90s retro weekend because you've got Captain Marvel going back to 1995, So let's go back to 1999 with Nicolas Cage, who stars as a private detective hired to track down the origin of an 8mm snuff film.
You know, my husband passed away recently.
Yes.
My husband was the only one with the combination to the safe. These were my husband's private things.
Private Detective Tom Wells is one of the only people who has seen it. It is 8mm wide. It runs at 16 frames per second. And he has been hired to discover...
All I want is to know that this atrocity is false.
This is one of those movies that was very notorious in its day. And actually on the special features, they've got a new interview with Joel Schumacher, who directed it. And he talks about, and everyone says this, oh, they'd never be able to make this movie today. That's BS. They've made movies like Human Centipede and the Serbian film. It may not have gotten a regular release, but this certainly would have made it no problem into the home video market. Could they have done a major release of this? I think they could, because what was shocking back then is a little more tame right now. In the behind the scenes, he talks about how notorious the script was because it deals with going into the seedy underbelly of the underground porn world in Los Angeles. I remember seeing this movie in the early 2000s on video, just because I was catching up on films. And, you know, I kind of have this weird love-hate relationship with it because on one hand, I think at least the first half is a somewhat compelling detective story. And I do like that it shows the 99% perspiration work that a private detective would go through to do his job. Of course, he's got to go and look through all these files to find a missing girl and then track them down. And what he did, I thought that was a fascinating element to it. When he gets deep into trying to track down the producers of this notorious film, it gets a little goofy. And what's weird about it, and this is very sort of almost puritanical, which is, it takes, you know, like I said, it was made in 1999. So it's right at that tipping point before the internet really got sophisticated, right around 2000. So it was still a lot of things were happening on the fringe, but I mean, it's almost weirdly judgmental when he goes into like an adult bookstore and like, oh, all my fellow perverts in here. And oh, isn't it awful? These people are disgusting and filthy. And then one scene, they say, oh, well, you know, I like porn as much as the next guy, but I don't get into that crazy stuff and wouldn't shop here. And I'm like, in the same sentence, they basically say, yeah, guys, all guys look at this stuff, but it's just also this fringe. And then they go into this deep dive into some of the most extreme stuff. I'm not even going to say what's on there, but they're like, pretty extreme stuff is being sold in these underground lairs. And then he's like, you got a snuff film? I'm like, oh, don't do that. I'll kill you if you assume that I'm going to do a snuff film, which I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense, really, if you think about it. It's written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who did Seven. And he was known, especially in the 90s, for those very gritty, just filthy kind of movies you watch, and the characters were so gross that you wanted to take a bath afterwards. So the last half of this movie gets goofy. And it's also has this weird soundtrack, this sort of Middle Eastern music soundtrack as they're like going through Los Angeles. I don't understand that, but that's what they do. So there's elements to it that I think are interesting, but ultimately it gets almost too Hollywoodized for a movie that was supposed to be breaking taboos in Hollywood. Still, it's an interesting little relic from the 90s before the 2000s took over. And, you know, it's a neat little throwback to, you know, a decade, 20 years ago. So I'm going to have to say that 8mm, I'm going to be nice and say kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quick. Last week, it was not a huge week at all for the new movies. Although Tyler Perry's A Madea Family Reunion almost made it to the top. It overperformed, but it still didn't beat How to Train Your Dragon. This just shows that Tyler Perry still has fans out there and they're going to go see the movie. And it's been a while since they've had a Madea movie. So yeah, you're going to get a little bit of a bump. Greta came in like eighth place with less than $5 million. Not a huge seller, but I don't think it cost all that much to make. And of course, Alita Battle Angel is actually doing quite well overseas. So it's going to probably end up making its money back, just not in the American box office because it's, you know, less than half of what it cost to make the movie. And the Lego Movie Part 2 should, by the end of this weekend, crack $100 million. But that's about it. Green Book got a bit of a bump, obviously, from winning the Academy Award. So did Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, but that didn't even make it into the top 10. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is another gritty 90s thriller, California, the collector's edition from Shout Select. David Duchovny stars as a writer developing a book on serial killers who unwittingly arranges a rideshare across the country with a real serial killer.
A book on some of the most infamous murders in American history. I want to go to where they lived and where they killed, and I want you to take the pictures, and I'm going to write the text.
Looking for somebody to take turns at the wheel and share expenses on a week-long cross-country Blue Highways tour of historic murder sites? Brian, who in their right mind is going to want to do that?
Early, tell me more about California.
I think we should have at least met them first. Beggars can't be choosers.
You ain't never killed no one, have you, bro?
No.
This is one of those movies, kind of like Nighthawks. I remember seeing bits and pieces of it, and I think where I saw bits and pieces of it was like on a HBO preview when in the 90s, after college, my parents got cable finally, and of course they always have those HBO and Showtime previews, and I swerved into part of the movie because I remember seeing bits and pieces of it, like a graphic scene, so it wasn't like from the trailers. But I'd never watched the movie all the way through. I never really had too much of an interest. It is one of those, again, somehow the 90s had these road movies and these gritty, like just sort of seedy movies. They had a lot of those. What's interesting is David Duchovny was in this movie. He was a nobody at the time. He was doing like Red Shoe Diaries on Showtime. The movie was released a week before the X-Files premiered on TV. So it happened right at the same time, and of course, within a couple weeks, David Duchovny had become a sensation, and even at the time, Brad Pitt wasn't even a huge name. Juliette Lewis, I think, was probably the one that most people were noticing in that one, because she was coming off of Cape Fear at the time, but this one... It's strange because you've got an unrefined David Duchovny who's still young and hadn't gotten jaded to Hollywood yet and was still even then trying to do more edgier stuff. Michelle Forbes from Star Trek's in it. She's okay in the movie. The problem with this movie is it's just so seedy and they make the character of Early, who's played by Brad Pitt, who's the serial killer. They make him into such a honky tonk stereotype. It's absurd and ridiculous, and he's got this drawl of an accent. I mean, you see, it's like if you said, "Oh, draw a serial killer from the hills," and that's what you'd draw. And that's, I don't find that scary. The kind of serial killers you find scary are the Ted Bundy types, the ones that are nice and real psychopaths who know how to manipulate people and know how to pretend to be really nice. This guy's just a goofball that ends up murdering people and somehow never gets caught, which is absurd in itself. But even like his parole officer is this skeezy, sleazy guy who comes to see him and he's in this ill-fitting suit. I mean, everything about this movie is like overdone in a sleazy context. And then on top of it, they're idiots. They do this rideshare and don't know anything about somebody. There's warning signals all throughout the movie. And then he's like, oh, he's attacking me. He's trying to kill me. And all you're doing is causing more people to get killed. So... it's a frustrating movie because it's an interesting kind of archetype from the 90s, and these road movies, very much like the apartment thrillers that I talked about last week with like Single White Female, was a neat subgenre in the late 80s, early 90s. You know, with California, you also had Breakdown. The Hitcher from the mid 80s is another road film, but those were kind of a staple of lower budget films. And this one never quite gels and spends too much time trying to be edgy and trendy and sleazy and gross and never really kind of makes it. So I'm going to have to say that California kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Other home video releases this week include Creed 2, Vox Lux, Instant Family, The Favorite, and Ben is Back. And that is it for the show. Next week, I'm going to be talking about 5 Feet Apart and Wonder Park. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.